The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Now, here's a story, a heroic story, that begins with a single intriguing line.
I heard that he had helped some people get off of a boat when I asked about this really ugly clock that we had hanging in our living room.
The solved mystery of an ugly old clock revealed a bigger mystery of heroism and luck that saved more than 30 lives back in 1952. The real-life story behind the movie The Finest Hours. We'll talk to the proud daughter of a Coast Guard hero of what's believed to be the greatest Coast Guard sea rescue in history. Also rescuing students from the stress of what a Harvard educator believes is a flawed college admissions process. But first, I suppose that it made sense that the end of the pre-caucus debate season for the GOP was a two-ring circus, 2 miles apart in Des Moines, Iowa. Donald Trump had his own event with veterans because of his anger at Fox News over, by the end of the evening, a number of things, he said. The rest of the candidates squared off by themselves at the Iowa Event Center in Des Moines. What have we learned, though, as we head into the actual delegate counting? Not from this debate, but from the entire period here. These candidates that are unfamiliar, now very, very familiar. We turn to Henry Barber in Mississippi, a Republican strategist and national committeeman for the Republican National Committee. The name Barber is a GOP establishment name. His uncle, Haley Barber, was once Mississippi governor and chairman of the RNC. And like the GOP old guard, Henry is feeling the heat in 2016.
Well, there's not any doubt that most voters in America on both sides of the aisle are sick of D.C. They're sick of the Democrats. They're sick of the Republicans. You know, I think there's a pretty good argument. There's some success in government at the state level, at governors and legislatures. But in the federal government, you know, whether it's the EPA or whether it's Congress or whether it's the White House, pretty much sucks. And so people want change, and they're trying to figure out how to make a living. We're trying to figure out how to keep our country safe. And it just seems like sometimes it's clown time all the time. And then, you know.
But Henry, why have the governors done so badly if your thesis is that there's been success at the local level and the state level?
Well, that's a good question. And I have to tell you, I don't know that anybody has a good answer for that. But I don't think there's any question that governors have been successful at the state level. And I'm talking about Republicans and Democrats. But there's not any doubt, you know, that Trump particularly and Cruz to a lesser degree have tapped into the people who are concerned about the country's going the wrong direction, and folks are upset and angry and understandably so with DC. But I do think as we're getting now down to where people are actually going to vote on Monday in the Iowa caucus, that it looks like we're going to have Trump, Cruz, and somebody. And I think we're about to figure out here pretty soon between Iowa, New Hampshire, and probably South Carolina, who the somebody is. And it's really important, I think, that we get it down to three if Republicans are going to win the White House. And for me, that's why I got into politics. You know, you want to affect public policy. And if you can't win the general election, it doesn't matter. And my concern, John, is that Trump and Cruz would lose the general election for the Republicans. In many ways, I feel like they're running a campaign based on like 1972 demographics. It's not enough to just let's turn out all the white folks in the country. It's not going to win a national election today. It's certainly not the way for the party in the future. And that's why I hope that voters will look for a consensus candidate, whoever that might be, who is going to finish strong here in Iowa and New Hampshire, and I hope folks will rally around them so Republicans will keep Hillary Clinton out of the White House.
As I passed through Logan Airport in Boston traveling over the weekend, I noticed for sale were Dump Trump in 2016 sweatshirts. Are you one of those dudes?
I'm one of these dudes who wants to Republicans to win the White House. We cannot afford a third term of Barack Obama. the foreign policy failures, the weak economic recovery, it's not working. And so that's why, you know, whether it be Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or Mike Huckabee or Chris Christie or whoever, we got to have somebody who could win a general election. And I don't believe that's Ted Cruz or Donald Trump.
All right. But is part of the problem that, you know, this it's not working rhetoric is just not flying? I don't care if you're talking about Democrats or just Americans don't see a disaster here. They would love to have some new ideas. OK, I'll go with you there. Something as an alternative to Barack Obama. But they're not buying this. We're on a precipice. We've lost the country. Our military is going, you know, south, and you know, some Iranian with a cell phone is going to take over America. I just don't think that rhetoric works.
At the end of the day, I think people want folks who can get things done in Washington. And I don't think Barack Obama's been much of a president. I think he's a pretty weak president. And he's done a pitiful job of certainly working with Congress and working with others in the sandbox. I think that's something folks are looking for. I think on the Republican side, you know, we're particularly looking for somebody that's strong. Even though I would argue on the Democrat side, you know, I think that's part of the appeal of Bernie Sanders. I mean, I think he and Trump, to some degree, sort of tap into this populism, that the desire for, you know, somebody to connect with the voters, kind of on the left edge and the right edge, to get them.
Let's just stop right there. So
yes,
Sanders and Trump are the nominees. Would you advise Michael Bloomberg to get into the race and totally twirl the roulette wheel?
If he gets in the race and it's Sanders and Trump, it's like roulette wheel. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen there.
Let's talk about, just forget Trump for a minute. And I have a lot of fatigue for some of the things that you're describing as well here. But it does seem that the lesson of this whole period is that for all the talk about we need consensus, we need consensus, we need consensus, it seems like anger beats consensus.
You're right. I mean, anger is selling. And we shall see, you know, what that means come Monday, both on the Democrat side and the Republican side. If some of these people who are particularly angry, but who haven't normally participated in the caucus, are they going to show up? And I tend to think a lot of them are. I tend to think that Sanders is probably going to beat Hillary just because I think he's got the energy on his side, which is part of it to do with the anger. And I think Trump's going to win on the Republican side. And Monday in Iowa, it's going to be exciting. But it's just the start of a long process.
So your theory is, Henry Barber, that the race begins on Tuesday.
There are going to be some people who drop out, I would think, after Monday. I mean, if they don't perform well, and you got a bunch of campaigns who are very low on cash, and you know they're barely able to make payroll, so there's a lot of pressure on them. So the race certainly will change on Tuesday, because we'll figure out who's getting out, who's got momentum. And then we're headed to New Hampshire the following Tuesday, February 9th. And then South Carolina, my opinion is, after South Carolina, it needs to be down to three if Republicans are going to nominate somebody who actually can beat Hillary Clinton. And for me, that means somebody other than Trump and Cruz.
Henry Barber, Republican strategist and Republican National Committee member from Mississippi. Thanks so much, Henry.
Thanks, John. Take care.
I'm staking my claim. Remember my name. You're gonna hear from me.
Eyeglasses and the use of human-made lenses to correct and enhance vision have all been around since the 13th century. Nobody knows who the inventor was. They were part of the innovation surge that took place in the European Renaissance. The USA produced something similar and just as portable for the ears, the hearing aid. And here to pitch the latest entry in our Greatest American Innovation series is someone who wants the hearing aid to stand next to such oddball entries as the electric guitar, the sewing machine, and Kevlar. I think the air conditioner entry is a clear earthshaker top five, but I don't know about some of the others. But don't forget to make your voice heard. You can vote for America's Greatest Innovation or nominate one of your own at thetakeaway.org/innovation. And now for today's pitch, the hearing aid. Can it hold a candle to an air conditioner? Well, that's for you to decide. Listen carefully.
Hi, I'm Richard Einhorn. I'm a musician, a composer, and a Grammy Award-winning producer.
Now, from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London.
I'm willing to bet that you love the radio as much as I do. Maybe it's something we take for granted. Unless you're one of 37 million adults in the U.S. who suffer from some kind of hearing loss. Luckily, we've come a long way since the 19th century, when the only solution to hearing loss was the ear trumpet. It actually worked pretty well, but it looked ridiculous. So let's take a moment to praise an American engineer named Miller Reese Hutchinson, who came up with the first battery-powered hearing aid in 1898. After a few tweaks, his device was small enough to be carried around in a bag or a purse.
In striking contrast, designer Sheila Ingram demonstrates one of the latest sub-miniature transistor hearing aids with a tiny battery that lasts for about 30 hours.
In 1955, a company in Ossining, New York, called Sonotone International, produced the world's first behind-the-ear model, which is still a very common style of hearing aid. Modern hearing aids are extremely sophisticated, truly a miracle of science. They're small and discreet. They amplify some sounds while reducing others. As I mentioned, I'm a musician, so it's important to me that the audience can hear my compositions. But there's another reason why I'm so passionate about hearing aids. I wear them every day. Several years ago, I woke up to find that all the hearing in my right ear was gone, probably due to a viral infection. My right ear never came back, and my left ear, already not doing well, got worse. I thought, how am I ever going to hear anyone again? But with hearing aids, I can stay connected to other people. American Ingenuity has transformed my life and the lives of millions around the world. So, here's an invention worth hearing about. Use your head, but also listen to your heart as I ask for your support for the hearing aid. Let's make one of America's smallest innovations one of America's greatest, too.
You heard Richard. Now go vote. Many of you have been sharing your ideas. Wyoming, Pennsylvania, Peter says self-absorbent two-ply. If you've ever used pre-1960s European or others, it's like using notepaper at best, sandpaper at worst. Thank you, Pete.
This is Jake from Stillwater, Oklahoma. The greatest invention of all time is the threaded fastener. Things like screws, bolts, nuts. Think of all the things that have been constructed with threaded fasteners.
Jake, quick Google search says the screw was invented in 400 BC, so takes it out of the American innovation domain.
Hi, this is Carol from Flower Mound, Texas, and my grandmother thought the greatest invention was window screens. And when you look back at it, it got rid of mosquitoes and malaria and a lot of other diseases. That's my take.
Carol's grandmother just might be onto something. Mosquito netting has been huge around the world. The Gilbert and Bennett Manufacturing Company in Connecticut invented the wire mesh window screen back in the 1840s. Visit thetakeaway.org/innovation to formally nominate an invention for this challenge or vote for one you've heard on the air. Again, that's thetakeaway.org/innovation. Make your voice heard on this great invention called radio, or streaming, or the internet. Getting into a good college has become, in our time, the most controversial process facing young men and women bound for higher education. Does the admissions process, with all of its stress, deliver what it promises for society at large, for students, and at what price, in the form of life-threatening stress for teens? Does anyone like the current situation? How would some radical changes in the process make it a better predictor of success in college? Richard Weisbord thinks he has an answer. He's a professor at Harvard University's School of Education and co-author of a new report on changing college admissions, Turning the Tide, Inspiring Concern for Others, and the Common Good Through College Admissions.
We have been doing surveys of high school students. We now have surveyed probably 20,000. One of the questions that we ask them is, what's most important to you, achieving at a high level, being a caring person, or happiness? We also ask them to rank what's most important to your parents. You know, about 20% of kids ranked caring first. That means 80% of kids said that achievement or happiness was more important to them than caring for other people. They were even more likely to think that their parents would prioritize achievement and happiness over their caring. So, you know, I think that we have really elevated achievement and happiness as the primary goals of child raising. Those are the messages that our kids are getting. And concern for others, concern for the common good has been demoted or sidelined, maybe to a degree that's unprecedented in our history. And at some point, you know, it dawned on me that the college admissions process is one of the only rites of passage we have in this country. It is a very powerful opportunity to send different messages to kids.
And what things would you change to begin to achieve the overall goal? And it is, again, a daunting one that you have underscored in this report.
Well, the two things that we are really calling for in the report are meaningful ethical engagement, concern for others, concern for the common good, and meaningful intellectual engagement. It's not about long brag sheets. It's not about how many achievements that you can rack up. And, you know, right now, there are a lot of kids out there who are taking 7 or 8 AP courses, are loading up on extracurricular activities, and we're making a quality versus quantity argument. You know, much better to focus on a few subjects that you feel passionately about, that you have, and much better to have, you know, to cultivate real intellectual vitality and engagement. And similarly around ethical engagement, that we're wanting kids, you know, doesn't have to be about creating a program in Costa Rica. It can be about meaningful engagement service in your community, you know, an unsafe park, an environmental challenge, sexting, you know, there are a variety of things. And it doesn't have to be just about individual service. I do think there is some distrust of college admissions and cynicism, but one of the things that I found, again, in this work with college admissions officers is that these are folks that are looking for great kids. They really are looking for kids that have real intellectual passion and ethical passion and are trying to do the right thing.
And they're looking for those kids, but not succeeding in finding the ones in low-income and disadvantaged neighborhoods and ethnically diverse communities. Why is that the case, and how would your changes affect that?
There are a lot of low-income working-class kids who are working to support their family, or they're taking care of a younger sibling, or they're taking care of a sick relative, and those are very substantial and demanding contributions. And those often aren't counted in the admissions process, and they're usually not counted because students don't know to report them, that they're important to report. So we're trying to make a strong and clear statement here that those contributions are very important, that we really need to do a better job of capturing the strengths and contributions of students across race, culture, and class.
Is the culture of a university like Harvard, and compare it with other institutions, is it more or less ready if tomorrow I snap my fingers and, in fact, the student body was suddenly as diverse and as inclusive as you imagine this could possibly be if these changes were implemented?
So I have very little involvement with undergrads at Harvard. I don't know a lot about the undergrad culture at Harvard. I will say that in general, and the data support this, that many of the very selective schools are hard for low-income kids. There is culture shock. There's lots of things that are alienating to them. They're not inclusive environments in the way that they could be. And I think there are good folks at these selective colleges who are trying to figure this out. You know, there are really high problems with college attrition in among low-income kids. A lot of kids aren't staying in college. So figuring out these issues of really creating an environment that's inclusive and supportive across, you know, race, culture, class is critical.
Finally, you know, one of the problems that you identify in your report, and it is not unfamiliar to people listening, I'm sure, is that people try to game the system. So you're going to create a new system, people will try to game it. Period, the end. I mean, how do you keep ahead of that? I mean, that's a real chicken and egg proposition that, you know, you should go into a cave and secretly come up with some new paradigm that no one can game because it'll be a mystery, like the secret ingredient of Coke or something.
Well, I think you can do better about gaming. I mean, you can do better in the sense that you can, in recommendation forms, we have recommendations for changing recommendation forms, you know, asking recommenders to be very concrete and to give specific examples of ethical character. We are also asking students to get recommendations from people they provide services for. I mean, I think you can make systems harder to game, but the reality is that there are many students who will continue to game the system. And, you know, our hope is that what we're motivating them to do is going to be better than what they're currently doing.
Richard Weisberg, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Richard Weisberg is a professor at Harvard University's School of Education and co-author of the report Turning the Tide, Inspiring Concern for Others and the Common Good Through College Admissions. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. With thoughts on the college admissions process fresh in our minds, we return to Lake Area Technical Institute in Watertown, South Dakota, to see how they are reshaping their programs to identify and meet real employment needs in the community. Lake Area Technical Institute is one of the featured schools in our Community College Challenge series. Today, we're taking an in-depth look at Think Big, one of Lake Area Tech's industry programs. The goal is to prepare students for high-skilled, paying jobs in South Dakota.
Probably one of the biggest programs is our Caterpillar program. We're one of 17 facilities in the world and one of 11 in the nation that offer the Caterpillar Technician Training Program.
And green wires, one of them you should have 2.4 volts on, the other one you should have 2.6. Use B for your ground, and that'll verify your ground is good.
My name is Alec Lee. I'm 19 years old, and I'm studying the Butler Think Big program at Lake Area Tech. I decided to come here because it's close to home. Also, it's a really, really good school. It's one of the top tech schools in the nation.
My name is Corey Muschitz. I am the Think Big instructor for Butler Machinery here at Lake Area Tech. My job is to teach everything on the machine, whether it be engine, hydraulics, electrical, air conditioning, powertrains, welding. If they make it through the Think Big program, they are guaranteed a job with Butler Machinery Company.
What I'm doing here is I'm going into this engine, into the computer that's connected to it, and I have it hooked up to my laptop here, and I'm going in and making sure all the parameters are correct.
I am doing my internship at Aberdeen at Butler Machinery. Here at the school, Corey, he's very, very good with everything. He'll make sure everybody in the whole room understands what's going on, what needs to happen, and how to do it correctly and safely. So
we work very closely with the employers. Usually it's on a day-to-day contact with them. The instructors in the Think Big program came from industry. Lake Area has hired us. They are also helping compensate our wage. Butler is helping compensate the wage. It's a very joint venture. So we just got this engine from Caterpillar donated to us, and now we're wiring it up to make it communicate to our diagnostic program. So we're having communication troubles right now, so we're troubleshooting what's not talking to what.
The biggest challenge for staying and attending college would probably be it's expensive. Say with like our tools that we had to buy, you got to buy a toolbox, and it depends on what brand you go, but not everyone can just pay with for almost $10,000 worth of tools right out of their pocket. So they go through the school, and then it's kind of like a loan, and you make payments through that. So that really does help out a lot, and they understand that that's a pretty hefty price to pay right away, right out of your pocket. We really can't go without the tools. That's kind of how we make our living.
Right here is telling me that the engine speed is about 600 RPM. That's just a normal idle speed. It's telling us we got good engine oil pressure, 41 PSI, that's pretty good. And fuel position is 1.9, that's good. And if we speed up the engine, it'll speed up and tell us what it's running at.
My hopes for the future would be to create a successful career out of what I've learned here at Lake Area Tech and also through Butler Machinery. That's my goal.
Working with the students, you can truly see they care. You can see when they come in here, they're scared. There may be some maturity issues to deal with. But by the time they graduate, they're like almost like your little brother. It's just a wonderful thing to watch them grow up, mature, become productive members of society.
That's Think Big instructor Corey Muschitz and student Alec Lee. How do schools in your community stack up? We've mapped over 1,000 community colleges across the country. Head over to thetakeaway.org/communitycollege to interact with our data. Stories of real-life heroes are on our minds today. Who are the heroes in your life? Eugene, Oregon. Shannon Gohl, the physical therapist that saved my life and gave me the education to build a new life.
Hi, my name's Bob, calling from Needham, Mass. My hero is Lynn Bradley. 31 years ago, she started a program of bringing an acting troupe of recovering addicts and alcoholics into schools to put on plays that give a message of hope and educate kids about the dangers of substance abuse. They also address issues around substance abuse in the family and how people can get help for those issues as well.
Chicago, Illinois. Robert Smith in 1953 at Camp Henry Horner, one of the few racially integrated camps then in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Robert was a 9 or 10-year-old African-American boy and the best athlete in my cabin of mainly white kids, all of us from Chicago's west side. Somehow, I became the target of white bullies. One afternoon, the bully boys had me floored, one astride my chest while the other sat on my head and punched me. Smith threatened he would beat them both up if they didn't get off of me. They kept pounding me, and after another warning, Smith jumped them from the high bunk and literally banged their heads together. I never forgot Robert, and it was probably no coincidence that 10 years later I was eager to join CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, led demonstrations to integrate Chicago's public schools, and have stayed involved in civil, human, and labor rights struggles all of my life. Thanks to Robert Smith.
Jennifer Trotter, and I'm from Grand, Oregon. My hero is my best friend, Ginger Johnson. She comes from childhood abuse and teenage pregnancy to get her college education, start a small business, run our small town fair board, and still found it within her to take on 2 foster teens. This woman can do anything.
Dallas, Texas says, my hero is my daughter, Sarah. She decided that she was supposed to be a boy and shared that with me rather than hiding it. I'm very proud of her. Some great hero stories from you. And now a look at a real-life rescue hero story that was nearly lost to the world except in the whispered modesty of some folks from more than a half century ago.
Obviously, I didn't know my dad at that time, and I didn't know anything about the rescue until I was in my teens.
That's Patty Weber Hamilton speaking of her dad, Bernie Weber, responsible for one of the greatest rescues at sea of all time. Patty says it was a story hidden behind the mystery of an old-fashioned, unsightly clock on the mantle.
I heard that he had helped some people get off of a boat when I asked about this really ugly clock that we had hanging in our living room. And it was off of the Pendleton. Years after the rescue, a man handed my dad a paper bag, and in it was this clock from the Pendleton. And then in, I believe it was 1984, my dad wrote a book, Chatham the Lifeboatman. And I thumbed through it, and I was like, oh, wow, this is interesting. And the big celebration that the Coast Guard did for my dad was the 50th anniversary, and I sat there going, holy cow, this is amazing what they did.
Yeah, can you imagine? Here's the Coast Guard's greatest hero, and he hadn't even told his daughter what he did.
Bernie Weber answered the rescue call off the coast of Cape Cod, Massachusetts, back on February 18, 1952, from one of the worst storms nature has ever delivered. A storm with the power to rip apart 2 stricken oil tanker ships.
I remember Bernie telling me he was scared as all heck, even hoping that maybe they'd order him to turn back. But when they said proceed as directed, then he knew he had a job to do. And he said, I wasn't even focused on the oil tanker. I was focused on the first step, which is get over the shallow area where the big booming waves come in and break.
That's Michael Togas telling the story of the U.S. Coast Guardsman Bernie Weber, who led his small crew on a 36-foot lifeboat to rescue the sailors stranded on the sinking SS Pendleton, which had split in 2. Togas captured the true life story in his 2009 book, The Finest Hours, that's now a blockbuster movie of the same name. Bernie Weber passed away in 2009. The Finest Hours is a stunning account of an unlikely rescue that happened, it seemed, in an eye blink.
I think it all happened so fast, and everybody jumped off of that tanker and got into that little boat, that it was just one of those things where it all happens, and then it's like, oh, no, now what? and we just got to turn around. And my dad made the decision to turn off the radio and to head to shore because he wasn't going to take them any farther out to sea. They wanted him to proceed to the Pollock.
Yeah, he was getting so much advice over the radio. I said, well, what'd you do next? He said, turn it off.
Yeah.
It was making me nervous.
It was Weber's swift and resolute decision-making that brought 32 crewmen from the Pendleton safely to shore. But a hero's welcome wasn't what Bernie Weber was prepared for.
He did say, when we were researching the finest hours, that being a hero can be a terrible burden. I had to give talks in front of rotaries. I would be transferred from station to station. There'd be some jealousy. And he said, sometimes rightly so, other people had done amazing rescues too, but I got all the attention. Bernie's largely regarded as the Coast Guard's greatest hero.
A designation Bernie never asked for and never much talked about. But Bernie did tell Michael he was pleased with the account that was written. His daughter Patty is proud to see the story told again on the big screen, and she feels there's a piece of Bernie in her too.
I definitely do. I've always found there's nothing I can't do. You know, there are hurdles. Sometimes things are difficult, but where there's a will, there's a way.
Patty Weber Hamilton, the daughter of Bernie Weber. Michael Tugas is the author, co-author of The Finest Hours. Disney's The Finest Hours, starring Chris Pine as Bernie Weber, is out today. Although Bernie once told Patty, if there ever is a movie made, have Don Knotts play me. Don Knotts, remember? He played Barney Fife on The Andy Griffith Show. Not exactly a romantic lead. Rafer Guzman, you saw the film The Finest Hours since it's Movie Friday here. What'd you think?
You know, Chris Pine is certainly no Don Knotts.
We know him
as Captain Kirk, right, from Star Trek.
Yeah.
I will say he's actually really good in the role as this very humble, unassuming Coast Guard guy. You might not expect that from Chris Pine. He's great in the role. I do wish this film had been a little bit less of a Disney film. I think it really sort of overblows the significance of this rescue, which is indeed a heroic feat, but I feel like the movie keeps wanting to trick you into thinking it's a World War II film and that what you're seeing is Normandy, when I feel like it should have just let the feat speak for itself. Do you know what I'm saying? So even though I like Chris Pine a lot, I'm not sure I could give it a wholehearted recommendation.
Great story, overblown sort of Disney morality, and it doesn't quite hang together.
A little too nostalgic and sort of a yearning for a nobler time and place in the past, I would say.
Kung Fu Panda. Now, this is a franchise that has done surprisingly well. Give me your assessment of the franchise, and then what's your assessment of Kung Fu Panda 3, and we've got a clip.
I was very surprised that this film did so well. I mean, it really didn't have much promise to me. I mean, it seemed, you know, very overstuffed. You've got a lot of these characters like Mantis and Crane that you know, that are sort of not that interesting in the first place. Jack Black, I think I like Jack Black as the Kung Fu Panda himself, but some potential for irritation there, I think. But the movies have consistently, I think, delivered. They are really smartly written. They've got a heart. The animation is always really lovely to look at. And they've just been winners across the board. And it really makes me wonder why other people don't try to put a little more effort and care into the children's movies that they make.
Well, here's the ensemble of Kate Hudson as Mei Mei, Jack Black as Po, and David Cross as Crane in Kung Fu Panda 3.
I am Mei Mei. Wow, she's amazing. She's so beautiful. That's sweet, Po. But please try to save all other compliments until after the performance.
Well, has it started yet?
Look away! Look away! No, you can't, can you?
Dad, why does she keep staring at me like that?
You know, it seems like this genre has matured in the sense, not just Kung Fu Panda, but some others as well, where you can do a kid's story without having to throw in some pop culture reference for adults every 3 minutes and then some scatological joke every 5 minutes. It seems like they're getting away from the formula and just doing great story.
Yeah, I mean, the other one that I would count like that is How to Train Your Dragon, which I've loved both of those as well. And this is very much like that. You know, in this episode, Poe has gone to his Panda Village. His father, played by Bryan Cranston, has come to reclaim him. They go to a Panda Village. He meets others of his kind. There's a villain named Kai, who's kind of a yak-like creature, played by J.K. Simmons, also a great actor, great voice. And these two stories dovetail detail. And again, there's a little too much going on, a little too much plot, but I think there are a lot of really good themes in this movie. You know, identity, family, friendship, maybe a little bit too many themes, but it's nice to see a movie that wants to actually deliver something to you and not just kind of amuse the heck out of you for 90 minutes because they think you're a five-year-old and they know that you'll watch anything.
And you might end up, saving an endangered species, right?
That's exactly right, and all of China.
Since when do you ever do that when you go to the movie? Number two here is Son of Saul. Tell me about this.
Very different film. This is a Holocaust film from Hungary about a man named Saul. He is one of the Sonderkommando, which were the Jewish prisoners in the camps that were made to usher their brethren into the showers, clean up, dispose of the bodies, do it again. And he sees his son die, and now he has a purpose. He wants to give this body a proper Jewish burial. It's an amazing film in terms of the filmmaking. Laszlo Nemes, it's his first film. You'd never know it. He films like a master. I'm a little unclear as to what this movie is trying to tell me in terms of what that dead boy represents, sort of the ghosts of the past, memories of the Holocaust. I'm not quite certain what the film is trying to say. I've been trying to get people I know to see the film. Holocaust movies are always a bit of a tough sell, but I feel like I'd like other people to weigh in on that.
Well, we've got a clip.
What do you eat?
Nein. Raus.
So in translation, that's of course in Hungarian there, but
Hungarian, German, right. I mean Yiddish. It's a real Babel, a real maelstrom of languages in this film, which is one of the things that I think really contributes to the intensity, the chaos, this chaos of the camps that has been condensed into this incredibly chillingly efficient process. It's really. Again, I keep using the word intense, but the film really grabs you by the throat, that's for sure.
And without the visuals here, you do get a sense that this is a process. They are doing a job that is utterly heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And again, you never imagine that you haven't heard a Holocaust story, but this is one that really jumps out. And it's in the Oscar.
It is. It was the first Hungarian film ever to win the foreign language Golden Globe. And I think it seems to be, at this point, a real front runner for the foreign language Oscar as well.
So Son of Saul and Kung Fu Panda 3 are those two offerings. Also, we talked earlier about The Finest Hours. We're going to do a little script sort of pitch game with you, all right?
Okay, you're going to pitch me a script?
We've asked listeners for their hero stories, their real-life hero stories, thinking along the lines of The Finest Hours. And here's a couple, and I want you to evaluate them.
This is Joey from Denton, Texas. Not only for his service, but what he's had to overcome and combat once medically retired from our armed services. My brother, Casey, who served during the last two wars within Special Forces 3rd Group, and I truly say without hyperbole that some of what he did will be in history books. The war he faces now is with PTSD, CTE, and myriad other medical problems along with broken vertebrae and seizures. This is at least a war that we as his family can help with. The night terrors alone would be too much for most, but every day he wakes dedicated to bettering his son and daughter's life with an outlook on the world that is inclusive and positive. We're all in this together. My brother, my hero.
You know, American Sniper was about a dad who couldn't function.
Sure.
Post-war, this is about a dad who can.
Sure.
It seems like an interesting possibility for a story.
You could have a twist there. I do think that the idea of the PTSD shell-shocked soldier has in some ways been done to death by Hollywood.
But it's always they can't make it. This
exactly.
is them making it. This is an interesting twist.
My nephew Alex is a hero. The lad got himself into Harvard on a scholastic scholarship. Then for Christmas, his Kickstarter campaign raised enough to purchase homeless kits comprised of waterproof socks and sleeping bags for the unfortunate souls on Boston streets. I've seen him grow as an infant into a man. If his father were alive today, why, he'd be bragging nonstop. Yeah, Alex, my young nephew, is a hero for those who really need one. The term is tossed around too often these days and should really be reserved for the precious few who make a real difference.
our listener Randy from Yankton, Oregon. It seems like that's a story that's been told, but it's a great one.
Maybe Pursuit of Happiness, maybe?
Yeah, we should work for Alex. We should get a job
exactly.
now.
Exactly. Well, we should start a Kickstarter campaign to make a movie about his Kickstarter campaign.
That's great. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
And here's something to take with you today. Thinking along the lines of Kung Fu Panda 3, the movie is enticing you to join the cuddly, awesome Zen world of Jack Black's Po Panda, perhaps. You'd have to put your head kicks and martial flips to rest. This job, it's a real job, taking care of baby pandas in Chengdu province in China. A professional panda hugger, it's called here, as at an official job description. Your work has only one mission, says the website at the Giant Panda Protection Research Center, spending 365 days with the pandas and sharing their joys and sorrows. You need perseverance for this job. $32,000 per year, salary deposited in your bank back in the States. Panda hugger, panda whisperer. You better develop a taste for bamboo. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.